And not just this lifetime, but all the lifetimes that we lived in ignorance. And what a tremendous task that is. Then we think, I could do that in one lifetime? That seems amazing. That could all be done in one lifetime. So our task is monumental, it's true. But we have grace. And grace makes everything possible. If you think about it, we just had this wonderful meal. Our bodies are busy digesting it. We don't have to consciously orchestrate. Okay, release these digestive juices, all right. Liver, you produce the bile, all right. Gallbladder, you inject it into the stomach system. And just think of the tens of thousands of functions going on to digest your meal. Where's the intelligence come from to make that happen? How does the body know how to do all of that? So it comes about that there's an intelligence that's operating inside of us. How much more true that is when we decide that realization is our goal. But what would we know to make that happen? There are physiological changes. It's actually quite amazing how physical spiritual experiences can come. The first time that I had Kundalini experiences, sitting in a group and meditating, Mother had talked about these Kundalini experiences, but I'd never had any such thing. And suddenly, at the base of my spine, there was like a snap. And with that snap came this tremendous force right up through my spine, came to the back of my head and straight across to the ajna, the third eye point here. And then it just created this tremendous pressure. It was very painful. This tremendous pressure and tremendous heat. And you have odd thoughts at times like this, but I thought I could fry eggs on this spot. It is so hot. And it may remain like that. And it's a little hard to gauge time, but maybe perhaps 10 minutes or so. And then it started to subside back down again. But there is always this sense after that, that this awareness of the spine and the flow of energy in the spine, and that Kundalini energy, which is specially condensed energy that's at the base of the spine, and in the Bible it's described as the serpent. So that the serpent in the Old Testament, in Genesis, is the oppositional force. Huh? It's the one who's the sneaky one and seduces, according to the story, Adam and Eve. Well, Adam represents reason, Eve represents feeling nature. And this downward-facing serpent is guiding all the life energy down into the lower chakras or the lower life centers in the spine. And as a result of that, we lose consciousness of our divine origins. What before had seemed self-evident suddenly seems non-existent, a mystery. And we're now wedded into this and welded into this body and body consciousness. So our task, when we feel that we are being awakened and lifted up, is to reverse that. And if you'll notice in the New Testament, all the references, and from the time of Moses, actually, Moses lifted up the serpent. He lifted up a serpent on a staff. The staff represents the spine. The serpent represents that divine energy coming up through the spine. And so you'll see the doctor's emblem. They borrowed it. And it has the two intertwining snakes that come up to the top and come up to the top of the staff. Originally, doctors were realized beings. And that as a result of that, then they could properly diagnose and treat somebody. These two intertwining serpents are the Ida and the Pingala. They're the two channels that are next to the spine. And they come up along with this Shushumna, the central spinal area. And that's where the proper channel for this serpent energy. And it rises up and it comes up. And when it gets to the base of the skull, it crosses right through and then comes here to this ajna, this third eye point. From there, it swings up to the top of the head. And if you see these statues of Buddha, you see a variety of representations, but one that I have at home, he has three rings. One is smaller than the next, and then there's a spire at the top. And this represents the three body level consciousness, the physical body, the electrical or the astral body, and then the causal body. Those are the three bodies we're encased in. And then the spire at the top represents transcending and going beyond all three bodies. And that's our task that's assigned to us as we go towards realization. And so this kundalini force, the serpent force, rises up through the spine, comes to the top here, and then swings its way out, and then it expands out into a universal, all-expansive consciousness. Now, these are a lot of words, but when the experience comes, then it comes as a very definite experience. And it's not just something that you imagine for yourself, or it is very powerful, and it is transformative. But just having that experience once or twice is not sufficient at all. That is the beginning of the purification. That's the beginning of our journey. So we enter into meditation again and again and again. Yogananda, mother used to call him master. And it wasn't that he was the master of her, like a slave and a master of that. He was master of himself. He had mastered these energies and had learned how to raise this kundalini force up and then to have this all-expansive consciousness and to be able to enter it at will so that he could sit. And one time somebody was asking to take a picture of him. And he said, just a moment. And tall outward appearance, he didn't change at all. But he lifted the consciousness all the way up into nirvikalpa samadhi. And he said, all right, you can take the picture now. He had that kind of mastery that he could do it in a moment. There's even a state beyond that. That's called nirvikalpa. The initial is sabbakalpa. Sabbakalpa is you're in the bliss and you're transmuted and lifted up into spiritual consciousness and your body is totally fixed. You are just in a completely still state. And really, because all of your life energy is in the spine and lifted up and just whatever is needed to continue the functions, and oftentimes your functions of your body even stops, you'll all of a sudden take a breath and you realize it's been a long time since I've had a breath. And you are in this suspended state of animation, but you're completely engrossed in this bliss and this upliftment in divine consciousness. And then you get to the state where you're able to begin to operate in the body so that you're not just in a fixed meditation spot. You're able to get up in your body, to walk, to be able to engage with the world. And in the beginning, it's very difficult. It's like living in a great reality, and the world doesn't seem quite real. It seems like a dream, and everything has a dreamlike quality to it. And you learn how to maintain this divine consciousness, even while you're doing other things, going about doing, perhaps going to work, carrying on conversations with other people. Now, it isn't all the time. So sometimes you have it and sometimes you don't. And as you work with it, you're able to take it more and more into your daily life. Now, why would we want to do that? It is, number one, a blissful experience. Bliss is different than pleasure. Bliss is really what we're all hungering for and what we really all love to have. But we look at for it in lots of different ways. We look at it in finding relationships. We look for it in family. We look for it in community. We look for it in many ways, accomplishment at work and so on. But nothing ever quite makes a fit. It satisfies us for a little bit, But we're like that child at Christmas time. I want this toy. I want this toy. I want this toy. Finally, Christmas time comes. They get the toy. 2 weeks later, it's sitting out in the rain and it's rusting and it's all forgotten. On to the next toy. What's the next thing? We're like that with these things. Sometimes they last longer than that, but eventually the shelf life begins to wear out. And we begin to think, that's not quite it either. So we have this thirst, we have this yearning, always for something more. And the reason nothing ever quite satisfies it, because the world of the senses can't do it. Can't do it. Can't fulfill that yearning that we have deep in our heart and our soul. So eventually, we try out everything. I think of this world as a vast experimental laboratory. And everybody has their theory of what produces happiness. You know, the heroin addict thinks that that happiness is going to come through heroin. Somebody who loves their work and they see themselves getting empowered through it thinks I'll just create an empire and that'll be my happiness. Everybody has a theory of what's going to produce that happiness, and we're all working that out. And we do it on a daily basis. So whatever it is that you do in life, that's a result of your theory, your idea of what's going to produce happiness for you. Now the crazy thing is, we'll continue doing something, even though all the evidence shows us it doesn't produce happiness, it makes us miserable. And yet we still keep going down that single track thinking, I just need to turn a corner with this, I just need to get everybody else in agreement with me. You know, if the whole world agreed with me, then I'd be happy. When does that happen? Never. It's designed in to this world of duality. It can never hit the spot. Temporarily, yes, can give us some pleasure, some satisfaction. Permanently, no. So people even lose the idea that there's something more than this world, something more than rearranging the chess pieces on this board of the world. If I could just get everybody behaving, if I could just get everybody to be in their right space, then I'd be perfectly happy. And even if you imagine to get everybody into their perfect spaces, then they go and move without even asking your permission. They just go ahead and do it. So you think, if I just had a nicer boss, I'd be so happy. If I just found that special somebody, if my children only behaved, you know, the list goes on and on and on. And those are all of our theories about what produces real happiness, when the reality is it always exists inside of us. Remember that television show MASH, where they had an opening scene and they're looking toward the camera and you can see behind them this helicopter is coming. That's what they're waiting for, is this helicopter. And it's coming and coming, and finally they hear it and they all turn around, they respond to it. But they all think it's coming from the opposite direction. And that's how we are in this body. We open these eyes, we look out, we think it's out there. It comes from the outside in. That's what makes me happy. But it never works. It never satisfies. It's always coming from behind us. The moment we turn and make the mind inward, then we begin to access. But it doesn't come easy. Huh? The world, it has its demands. We're so habituated to this world. We close our eyes, we try to go inside, and what happens? We're thinking about tomorrow, we're thinking about yesterday, what happened earlier today, what's going to happen later. Completely occupies the mind. We're addicted to this world. And so we have to break that addiction and say, can I learn, can I teach myself to become focused here? So if we sit upright, and we can put our hands in a receptive position like this. Sometimes in the statues, you see people with their hands out there, but that pulls your shoulders forward, and it starts to impinge on your lungs. So you bring them back into your lap here, and you make them receptive. And then you become aware that you're breathing. Most all meditations begin with the breath. And so you begin with the awareness that you are breathing. Such a simple, simple thing. Something we've been doing ever since we were born. But how much awareness have we had about it? And so we're aware that we're breathing in, we're breathing out. Now what the yogis discovered is that language has a vibration to it, and vibration matches different states of consciousness. You know, you hear these cars going by, and they've got that great big old huge bass in the back, and I swear that for 2-block radius, it changes the heart rates of everybody who's in proximity of this. Hits right down at the base chakra. And fellows riding the motorcycles and the big Harley Davidsons, and it's got that deep vibrational growl. Hits very nicely, right down at the tailbone, right at the base vibration. It's stimulating something for them. There's a reason. You know, you can actually get a muffler for those things, but they don't. They actually like that sound because it's stimulating that chakra for them. So every sound has a vibration and corresponds with a different state of consciousness. So it makes you think, okay, what kind of sound do I surround myself with? Is it uplifting? Is it good? Is it positive? Or does it tend to draw me down into the lower centers? So that's something to think about. But you think this point here is the doorway toward divine consciousness. And it's the point at the eyebrows, and there are pictured there energies that are two in nature. And so they're pictured as two petals, these two energies there. And there's two words that can go and vibrate very nicely with this chakra. So that with every breath that you take, as you breathe in, mentally chant the word Hong, H-O-N-G. You breathe in and you mentally chant the word Hong. Now you don't try to breathe in deeply or try to moderate your breath at all. You just allow it to be the way that it is. So you breathe in Hong. You breathe out Sa. S-A-U. These are two Sanskrit words, and they translate into I am, the great I am, your true self. So with every breath, you're affirming the great I am inside of you. So as you breathe in, you think Hong and repeat that mentally. As you breathe out, you repeat Sa. You remain awake, but alert, but in a very still state. As you continue to concentrate on your breath, you'll notice that your breath will just naturally, without trying, will begin to slow down. Your lungs may expand. Because we hold a lot of tension oftentimes in our body. We're not even aware of it. As you breathe in and repeat these two sacred Sanskrit words. Now you can, if you like to, use the word I am as you breathe in and out. Just to help to remind yourself of this. The Hong Sa is specially tuned to the Ajna. As the mind becomes inward, you may be aware of a sound. It may come in, if you're right-handed, it may come in through your right ear. Or it may come in from behind you. If you're left-handed, it may come in through your left ear. And it's a high-pitched sound. The closest I've been able to describe it in nature is if you've ever been walking through the woods and there's rapids that are at a distance and you first hear that high-pitched sound coming through the woods, as you first hear that, it has a similarity to that, although nothing really captures it. And when you hear that sound, that Om sound, you let your consciousness expand with it. And at the same time, you maintain your awareness, your focus here at the point between the eyebrows. And there you may see a beautiful pearlescent white light. Sometimes it comes as a beautiful gold light, and sometimes beautiful deep blue. These are the three colors that most highly represent those states of consciousness. As you turn the mind inward, these centers can begin to open up. And these experiences are not imaginary. They become a reality for you. And lets you know that you're on the right road. And it starts with such a simple practice of Hong Sa. But don't allow the simplicity of it fool you into thinking that it's not very powerful. It's an extremely powerful practice. Master called it the mini Kriya, and that it has the power to take you all the way to the divine goal. Immediately you began to feel some peace and quiet, stillness. Read you something from Paramahansa Yogananda. This is a booklet that he wrote about Lori Mahashai, his param guru, his guru's guru. What is a divine incarnation? Incarnations of God are not souls who are dropped as perfect beings from heaven, imported into the world by God, but are those beings who by effort and meditation have removed all ignorance, knowing themselves in the earthly incarnation as perfect external manifestations of the potentially perfect images of God. One truly knows God, becomes God himself. The sunlight equally shines on the charcoal and the diamond lying side by side under the open sky during the clear day. So the charcoal and the diamond lying side by side. In spite of the impartiality of the sun, the diamond, by its own transparency, reflects the light of the sun more than the charcoal. Thus, in spite of God's impartiality, wise men reflect his light more than the ignorant. Prophets use their heaven-given independence to tune their free will with God's wisdom-guided will. Ignorant people use their free will to allow themselves to be controlled and misguided by their whims, moods, prenatal habits, and instincts. Therefore, different home-returning God's devotees are judged according to the qualitative and quantitative good they do to themselves and to the world. I think most all of us would like to do good in this world. We would like to help this world. We see this world and all the things that seem to make people's lives difficult. And our hearts go out to that. And we would like to be able to do something for this world. Now, there are many practical things that we may be able to do. One of the most powerful things we can do is make the spiritual transformation in ourselves. This is most powerful because we are all linked together. And when you are lifted up and purified in your consciousness, you are affecting all those who are connected to your life. And you are helping to lift them up as well. Now, you may be going about very quietly doing your spiritual practice. So it's not that you're making a lot of noise about it. It's simply that who you are begins to emanate out of vibration. I was once up by Babaji's cave, who initiated Lari Mahasaya. And it's a wonderful, wonderful area. It's in a small town called Dwarahat. And there's a ashram that is there. And I went to sleep about 10:30 at night, and suddenly right around midnight I woke up wide awake, and I just felt prompted to go up onto the top of the roof, and the roofs are flat there. And so the stairwell took me up there, and suddenly I was out. It was a perfectly full moon night. And there are two planets perfectly positioned on each side of the moon. And I thought poetically that it's like the two small eyes and then this huge ajna of the moon right in the center. So I sat meditating up there, and there's this most beautiful plant there. It's called Queen of the Night, and it's just got one of those intoxicating smells, and it comes out mostly at the night. And the only little thing you have to be aware of is that the snakes love this smell as well. So you want to be careful when you're wandering around at the night, because the snakes and the cobras love that smell. But two stories up, I could smell the smell, and it was so rich and intoxicating. And I went into a deep meditation for a while. And after some time, I came out of that. And then I stood up and I walked over by the side of the little hip wall that surrounded this rooftop. And so I was looking out at the top of a peak that's right nearby, Dronaguri, and on top of it is a small temple dedicated to Hanuman. It is said that that's the hill that Hanuman lifted up and took down to Lanka, if you know the story of the Ramayana. So I'm looking out at this little light that's shining from this temple up there. I'm looking at the moon and these two stars. And suddenly, this vibration came down, and it felt like a warm wind. And if you've ever been in a gully or in a valley, and suddenly a wind will just pick up and sweep by you, and then it's gone. And it was like that. And I could feel this vibration coming down out of the mountains and then sweeping by and going out to the world. And it was wave after wave after wave of this tremendously powerful vibration. And I knew that these vibrations were connected with meditating yogis up in those mountains that were sending out these powerful vibrations for the upliftment of the world. So you think that you're just sitting in your room and you're meditating, you're doing your hong sa, you're feeling more deeply connected. You have an effect on the world then. That vibration that you are putting out is going out to your home, to your community, to the world at large. And the greater the vibration, the greater the effect. So you think about the wonderful effects that are incorporated into this meditation practice. Your ability to help this world, to lift it up. It doesn't guarantee that all souls will be receptive. Some people are polarized against the light. As Jesus said, the darkness hates the light. But those who are attuned to it especially will feel that uplifting current. And you can be on the other side of the world, and somebody will come to your mind, and you'll suddenly, that power will transfer itself from you to them, just simply because they've come into your thoughts, and you are in tune with these powerful forces. So this is a wonderful practice, not only for yourself, but it helps to lift up and transform the world as well. I thought I'd read you a writing that I haven't posted yet. Usually I do it on Sunday morning, but it's been a busy day for me, so I haven't had time. And it's entitled, A True Sexual Revolution. And I put these postings on yogashariyadeva.com if you are interested in reading them. Periodically, we read of the public downfall of men and women due to sexual misbehavior. However, while these cases are portrayed as spectacular, sexual energy is very much with us and is highly influential in our everyday lives. It can be innocently making yourself look nice, or two available people flirting. Then it can take a dark turn to the extremes of predatory deviancy and sexual violence, and everything in between. To find the higher road of sexual energy is the task of all incarnated souls. This is especially true for those treading the path of spiritual practice who require keen awareness of its benefits and pitfalls. God designed human bodies to represent sexual opposites, male and female. It has been said that in the higher yugas, in more enlightened times, a couple could produce a baby without sexual contact through the power of thought or a touch of a hand. However, for most humanity today, coming together as man and woman is the typical means. What has been the most beneficial and successful formula around the world is for a man and woman to form a bond of committed marriage, then to raise children as a family. However, sexual energy does not simply run in straight lines of husband and wife. We must learn the wisdom of what it can do for us and how it can be our downfall. There is no doubt that Western society has become highly sexualized, with advertising, film, television, and print media all capitalizing upon the power of sex energy to sell products and ideas. There is precious little in these medias to support the beauty of a committed relationship, the sacrifice of love, and the benefits of transmuting sexual energy into creativity and spiritual realization. The effort to liberate sexual repression of the past all too often results in debasing relationships into serial affairs, the blatant use of sex to sell anything and everything, as well as the means to gain and exploit power. Those of us following a spiritual path must come to a right understanding of the role of sexual energy, finding in this most powerful human drive the very means for unleashing its spiritual potential. We know through our own experience how potent a force sexual energy is. From childhood to getting on in years, it plays a part in our lives. In religious tradition, sex is many times demonized for the downfall of mankind. And there is truth in this, but that teaching must be properly understood. The pre-existent soul is free of desire nature, of common human needs. It is pure light and consciousness. When soul consciousness mingles with earthly expression, it can be done with a light touch, producing no binding attachments. However, the soul can also become focused on the object of the senses, creating a desire for more and more. This desire nature creates a split of the human self from the real self. Now, instead of being a pure soul expression, awareness is driven by the desire nature. Sex, along with survival instinct and desire for power, are such incredible allurements that are sometimes satisfied, but always calling for more. Consciousness, controlled by these forces, falls from its original state of freedom and is at the beck and call of lower impulses. Sexual energy being so powerful and having such a drawing power becomes destructive and binding when unregulated in human affairs. Excuse me. It literally and symbolically is the counter opposite of spiritual freedom. For animals, sexual energy is powerful, but regulated by nature. Certain mammals mate only a few times in life, going years without reproducing. Higher human evolution loses connection with natural regulation. Many times, the higher the intelligence, the more cunning and dominant sexual desire can be. To recognize how powerful, pervasive, and destructive sexual energy is not to say it is all-powerful, but it is to recognize its importance and how demanding of a task it is to purify and transmute it. You can think of our mission as twofold. One is purifying sexual energy on a human level, and the second is raising and transmuting it into a wholly new paradigm, the superfuel for divine consciousness. In addition to transmuting sexual energy for spiritual advancement, we also know from history that many great artists and writers have been abstinent during times of intense creativity. The uprush of intense creative energy draws upon transmuted sexual energy. That is why there is no interest in the sexual act when the energy is flowing up in the spine to creative centers. This transformed energy takes away any urge for procreated activity and is not in any way repressing the energy, but giving it a creative expression. Purifying sexual energy on a human level means finding its beauty, its ability to be a creative force, and appreciating its power to bring about new life, a truly remarkable miracle. Mother is perhaps unique in spiritual annals, particularly in the West, for teaching the beauty of sexual expression on a human level. Anything from the use of makeup by ladies to gentlemanly behavior by men, she sought to bring out the best of behavior and consciousness between the sexes, not for the exaltation of base drives, but coming to know the real expression of soul through the body. At the infancy of sexual revolution of the 1960s, Mother's was a mature vision for finding the higher road of sexual energy. She delighted in being a woman. She deeply appreciated the role of men, was fully for equal pay for equal work, but also knew that men and women have some great and good differences. I have never known anyone, man or woman, so perfectly balanced in male and female energy. Yet she was always the perfect expression of a woman. There are many who followed Mother's teachings who were tripped up by sexual energy in their path towards God. While sexual desire can be a great oppositional force for the aspirant in their sadhana, there also comes a particular time when entering into spiritual experiences, when the full power of sexual energy emerges and seeks to reassert its dominance. Whatever latent desire nature is present, it is now given high-octane fuel from the serpent or kundalini force. Given the powerful role sexual energy plays from the beginning to the end of our spiritual journey, we must know its proper role and be its good and faithful steward. Keeping the utmost integrity in thought, word, and deed is your greatest ally as a devotee. When you feel sex energy stimulated outside of marriage, avoid the situation. Go deeper into prayer and communion with your infinite beloved. Surrender this impulse at the feet of the Lord and visualize the energy flowing up from the base of the spine into the higher centers of the heart, the ajna, and the sahasrara, or the crown chakra. This shifts your spiritual practice from any sort of crude form of repression to that of exalted transmutation of the energy. You teach yourself to appreciate the superior experiences of spiritual purity and freedom. Instruct the mind and desire nature. Quote, observe, see how the energy flowing up the spine leads to bliss, expansiveness, and freedom. Contrast that to how confining, demanding, and ultimately unfulfilling it is when I give in to it. Sexual energy is like a snowball at the top of the hill. If you stop it immediately at its beginning, you can more easily master it. If you give in to it, it starts rolling down the hill, and when you try stopping it, it becomes as big as a house. You will be hard-pressed to change it. However, a strong determination backed by divine will can move mountains and change the course of this runaway train of sexual energy. Spiritual freedom and purity are vastly superior to anything the five senses can offer. The body uses divine power and directs it through the nerves, so that when channeled through the senses, you experience pure spiritual energy only indirectly. However, when you have God experience, you tap directly into the source of the intelligence and power that is creating this entire universe. You may think of the yogi sitting in his cave in deep meditation as the one who is doing without, sitting all alone and not having anything interesting happen. In reality, he is united with the kingdom of heaven that is all bliss, fulfillment, and knowledge of God. He is a monarch, not of this earth, but of infinite spirit. By comparison, this earth in a carnal sense is grubby, shabby, and low grade. Husband and wife, through time and experience of deepening a relationship and spiritual attunement, can successfully transmute all experiences into spiritual experiences. Through divine prompting, there may be physical union that plays a part in their lives, which elevates the sexual experience into spiritual union. The after effect is then emerging into an ocean of infinite expanse. On a human level, there will always be differences between two people. But in spirit, there is a perfect joining of two souls into one. Mother said that such a union is the highest experience on a human level. When raised and transmuted sexual energy becomes the fuel for total spiritual union with God. The very thing that plagues the aspirant as oppositional force and proves to be the downfall of many now becomes his or her greatest ally. That is why in Genesis, the downward-facing serpent is later changed, and in the teachings of Moses and Jesus, the serpent force becomes upward-facing and leads to spiritual illumination. Through intelligent application of will, with a higher purpose in mind, the aspirant may realize the fullest benefits of transmuted sexual energy. Creating a list of don'ts without an understanding of its tremendous positive potential will lead to perversion. However, with a true understanding of all that sexual energy may do, the ways it can be transformed into creative endeavors and spiritual upliftment is the cause of true sexual revolution. And there's a wonderful book by Elizabeth Hike. She's left the body now, but it's entitled Sexual Energy and Yoga, and she speaks quite wonderfully on this idea of transmutation. And so we come to realize that everything that we need for this revolution of spiritual transformation is already contained in our bodies. We have all that is required. We have all the fuel for it. We have all of the life energy. We have all of the intelligence that is required to make this transformation. So all that is left is for us to apply ourselves intelligently and to begin to really put our feet upon this path, to really dedicate time and energy and commitment towards making this transformation. Really, you cannot imagine the total transformation that can happen from this. The state of bliss that you can have is so immense, so transformative, and it will fulfill all of your heart's desires. That's a big promise, but I can tell you that it is true. You do not need to change your name. You don't need to wear special clothing. You don't need to go to any other part of the world. It is all right here. And all that is required is for you to begin to apply yourself in earnest. This world has a very strong draw on us because we have spent a long time focused extremely on it. However, with putting these things to work, we can break free of the fetters of the things that bind us. Now, it is not to say that this world is bad or is wrong or anything like that. God created everything that is. And as he created it in its perfection and its purity, he said, it is good. It is good. So this creation is fundamentally good. But we have forgotten our divine nature. We have become so infatuated with the things of the senses that we no longer even think about what might be beyond them. And yet, we live in this vast world. Plato had the cave analogy. And in the cave analogy, set these individuals, and behind them was burning a fire. And they saw their own shadows up on the wall. And I was dancing along with the fire. And they thought that was the entire world. One day, one of the fellows, he got up, and he went outside of the cave. And he saw that there was this bright, beautiful world. Remarkable. Nobody had ever even guessed it. And he came back to tell others. And as he was telling others, they wouldn't believe him. And they completely ignored him. They thought that this world of shadows was everything. And that's the way we are with this world. The world of the body, the world of the senses. We think it's the be-all, end-all. And it's actually a very pale reflection of the divine life that is within us and all around us. So we need to wake up to this. We need to really assert ourselves and bring ourselves fully to bear upon it if we're going to break free from the fetters of this world. And as we do so, we enter into the spiritual world and we feel that bliss, we feel that transformation. And then gradually, as we are purified more and more, we come to that point where we then see that everything in this world, all the things that plagued us before and distracted us, are actually divine manifestations. There's nowhere that we can look that it is not so. Papa Ram Dass wrote the book, The World is God. And that's the way he experienced it. Everywhere that he went, everyone whom he met, was a manifestation of divine. Imagine having such a view of life, having such a transformation in your consciousness, where you could experience that. And you can read Papa's book, Swami Ram Dass, and as he talks about, with great humor and wonderful insight, about the spiritual journey that he took and was a complete makeover and transformation of his consciousness from the human to the divine. You'll see that it is possible, that souls have been doing it, and that the world is changing, and more are coming to be attracted and coming to know. Souls are coming into this incarnation knowing that there is something more, not satisfied strictly with the things of the senses. But we need to make a determined effort. We need to apply the tools that are given to us. And if we do that with heart, mind, and soul, our lives will change, never to be the same again. So let us think upon that and really go to work in ourselves. Let us purify this body, feed it only good foods, only good thoughts. Don't pollute this body with things that simply bind it more and more to this world. It doesn't mean you need to starve yourself, but give yourself only good thoughts, good food, good association, friends, people who support you in your spiritual journey. And then you will begin to see the changes. And you will become that soul that you have always been. And you will always be, only somehow you had completely forgotten the great God being that you were from the very beginning, from the very foundations of all creation. You are that. You are that now, and you will always be. But why live in a feeling of separation from that? Why not claim that spiritual heritage for yourself now? Let us close with some ohms. I bow to the light within you. May you be a light unto this world, giving it all of your love, all of your light, your very best. Let us leave quietly, taking this feeling with us, keeping this holy vibration, keeping it alive inside.